You're a podcast listener, and this is a podcast ad. Reach great listeners like yourself with podcast advertising from Lips and Ads. Choose from hundreds of top podcasts offering host endorsements, or run a reproduced ad like this one across thousands of shows to reach your target audience with Lips and Ads. Go to lipsandads.com now. That's LIBSYNads.com.
It's Friday, June 17th, 2022. I'm Jackson Bird. Today, ahead of Juneteenth, a reminder of what emancipation did and didn't do. Plus, a newly discovered group of polar bears who are able to survive on less sea ice than should be possible. And a promising milestone achieved in the field of space-based solar power. Here is some cool stuff for your ride home. This Sunday is Juneteenth here in the U.S., a day celebrated by Black Americans for generations, but this year marks only the second year that it has been recognized as a federal holiday, one which marks the emancipation of enslaved African Americans and more generally celebrates Black excellence and culture. And if Juneteenth is a newer holiday to you, I'll put links in the show notes to the segments I did on the origins and evolution of Juneteenth in previous years. And I especially recommend Annette Gordon Reed's Pulitzer Prize-winning book published last year called On Juneteenth. It's immensely readable and is written from the perspective of a native Texan, which I got a lot out of as a fellow Texan, but is also appropriate since Juneteenth has its roots in Texas. The original Juneteenth was June 19th, 1865, and it was the day that enslaved Black people in Texas were finally informed that the Emancipation Proclamation had in fact been signed 2.5 years ago, and they were almost legally, finally, free. Of course, as many have elaborated on over the years, the reality was a bit more complicated. Tufts University history professor Chris Manjapra dove into this in his book Black Ghost of Empire, as well as in a recent piece in The Conversation. He writes there, quote, "As historians have long documented, emancipations did not remove all the shackles that prevented Black people from obtaining full citizenship rights, nor did emancipations prevent states from enacting their own laws that prohibited Black people from voting or living in white neighborhoods. In fact, based on my research, emancipations were actually designed to force Blacks and the federal government to pay reparations to slave owners, not to the enslaved, thus ensuring white people maintained advantages in accruing and passing down wealth across generations," end quote. And Manjapra refers to emancipations plural because there wasn't just one big one that Abraham Lincoln signed into reality with a stroke of his pen. Between the 1780s and 1930s, Manjapra cites over 80 emancipations over the world, including 20 separate ones in the U.S. from the nation's founding through 1865. And many of those state-by-state emancipations included language that essentially set Black people up for failure, whether it was gradualism that literally kept them in servitude for a certain number of years or until a certain age, or the economic debt that they were forced to take on in order to exit slavery. Even when the 13th Amendment was ratified at the end of 1865, and the 14th and 15th in subsequent years, loopholes were included that continued to deny rights to Black people. The loophole in the 13th Amendment allowed for incarcerated people to be enslaved, which, of course, practically led to Black people being arrested for any kind of conceivable minor crime or for doing nothing at all, just being accused of something false. And then the 14th Amendment excluded incarcerated people from being able to vote. Now, if you want a comprehensive overview of how these unjust loopholes effectively continued slavery in this nation and how it has led to modern-day mass incarceration, I highly recommend Ava DuVernay's Oscar-nominated documentary 13th, which is available to stream on Netflix. Now, one of the points that Manjapra is making in reminding us of these realities is that while Juneteenth is a celebration, it is also a call to action. As he describes it, quote, "On that first Juneteenth in Texas, and increasingly so during the ones that followed, free people celebrated their resilience amid the failure of emancipation to bring full freedom. They stood for the end of debt bondage, racial policing, and discriminatory laws that unjustly harmed Black communities. They elevated their collective imagination from out of the spiritual sinkhole of white property rule. Over the decades, the traditions of Juneteenth ripened into larger gatherings in public parks, with barbecue picnics and firecrackers and street parades with brass bands. At the end of his 1999 posthumously published novel, Juneteenth, noted Black author Ralph Ellison called for a poignant question to be asked on Emancipation Day. How the hell do we get love into politics or compassion into history? The question calls for a pause as much today as ever before. End quote. And I want to further end this segment today with a selection from the poem Fury and Faith by Amanda Gorman, as read on NPR this morning at the end of a discussion about Juneteenth and the gift of blackness. This poem comes from Gorman's collection Call Us What We Carry. You can read the whole poem in that collection or listen to her full reading at the NPR link in the show notes. Here's an excerpt.
And though we are unstoppable, if we ever feel we might fail, if we be fatigued and frail, when our fire can no longer be fueled by fury, we will always be fortified by this faith found in the anthem, the vow. All Black lives matter, no matter what. Black lives are worth living, worth defending, worth every struggle. We owe it to the fallen to fight, but we owe it to ourselves to never stay kneeling when the day calls us to stand. Together, we envision a land that is liberated, not lawless. We create a future that is free, not flawless. Again and again, over and over, we will stride up every mountainside, magnanimous and modest. We will be protected and served by a force that is honored and honest. This is more than protest. It's a promise.
So this is good news, maybe, kind of. Researchers have found a group of genetically distinct polar bears who have managed to strike out a living for themselves in a location with so little sea ice that it should be impossible for any polar bears to survive. Now, given the long-standing fears about polar bears' survival in a world with rapidly melting ice caps, this is an intriguing and potentially helpful discovery. The researchers, whose findings were published yesterday in the journal Science, are working now to get this particular group of bears recognized as a subpopulation so they'll be protected from threats like hunting. Keeping this group safe could be exceptionally important, as they may be the key to polar bear survival in the face of the climate emergency. Or I might just be getting ahead of myself. More on that in a minute. Quoting The Verge, after putting satellite tracking collars on some polar bears across 1,800 miles of Greenland's eastern coastline, the researchers realized that bears living in the southeast of Greenland kept to themselves and didn't venture into places where they might bump into northeastern bears. Then, after looking at genetic samples, the researchers found that the southeastern bears are actually the most genetically isolated on the planet. That means that they haven't interbred very much at all with bears outside of their group. The bears had more surprises in store. The southeastern group had found a way to make a home for themselves in a place that should have been inhospitable. In the fjords where they roam, sea ice is present for only about 100 days of the year. And since polar bears hunt on sea ice, that normally would have left them with less than a third of the year to find food. Now, polar bears can fast for up to 180 days of the year, but in the absence of sea ice for longer than that in this region might have left them to starve. Luckily, the bears here found another resource when sea ice disappears: floating freshwater ice at a glacier front. Here, they could stalk seals from their breathing holes or sniff seals out from above and then break through the ice to reach them as they normally would on sea ice. End quote. Depending on freshwater ice occasionally is not unique to this group or an entirely unknown phenomenon among polar bears, but this group is unique in just how much they depend on it. Without it, they would not be able to survive in this habitat. And the freshwater ice that these bears are hunting from is specifically called glacial mélange, also the name of a new cocktail I'm going to design, calling dibs on that right now, glacial mélange. The New York Times described it a bit more in depth, quote, Southeastern Greenland is especially remote, with narrow fjords hemmed in by steep mountains. At the inland end, there are often glaciers that terminate in the water. At the other end is open ocean, with a strong south-flowing current. The freshwater ice these polar bears hunt from calves off from the glaciers into the fjords, as icebergs and progressively smaller chunks, and that persists most of the year. The bears hunt from this floating mix of ice, called glacial melange, in the same way they hunt from the sea ice. But habitats like this are rare, said Chwila Moon, a scientist with the National Snow and Ice Data Center in Boulder, Colorado, who analyzed sea ice and glacial ice cover in the fjords as part of the research. There are limited locations in the Arctic where we see substantial and consistent production of glacial melange, Dr. Moon said. So while these special conditions may allow some bears to survive as the sea ice continues to shrink, overall, the animals will continue to be threatened by climate change. Stephen Omstrup, chief scientist with the conservation group Polar Bears International, who was not involved in the research, said he agreed with the researchers that, as he put it, this is not some kind of salvation for polar bears. For one thing, he said, warming is causing all kinds of ice to retreat and disappear, including glaciers. So the glaciers in the Greenland fjords will not continue to terminate in the water and produce glacial melange forever. The study, he said, is showing a transient benefit for these bears. End quote. So not only does the unique survival method of this one group of polar bears not mean polar bears everywhere are saved, the unique method for this group might not even last all that long. Kind of a bummer, actually. As Science Alert reminds us, quote, polar bears are listed as vulnerable to extinction, according to the International Union for Conservation of Nature Red List, and there are around 36,000 individuals left in the wild. But some studies have suggested that the species could vanish by the end of the century due to the effects of climate change. Warming temperatures in the Arctic mean that sea ice is melting sooner and freezing later, pushing polar bears to the brink of starvation. End quote. As lead author Dr. Ledra reaffirmed, quote, loss of Arctic sea ice is still the primary threat to all polar bears. This study does not change that. End quote. So I finally started the newest season of For All Mankind earlier this week. The second episode of season 3 just dropped on Apple TV Plus today. And if you haven't heard me rave about it before, it is an alternate history kind of show in which Russia beat the US to the moon, and therefore the space race never ended. Because the US actually had some competition, we much more quickly found water on the moon, built up moon bases, diversified the astronaut program, and much more. The show begins in 1969, but this most recent season picks up in the early to mid-90s. And what's particularly fun about the show is all of the other knock-on effects that the show creators decide to incorporate based on that one initial change to history. Now, none of what I am about to say is super crucial to any plots or contains any significant spoilers, but jump ahead about 30 seconds if you want to go into the show knowing absolutely nothing. So, the show creators introduce knock-on changes to our history like Star Wars sweeping the 1977 Oscars because the country has space fever, John Lennon not being assassinated, Prince Charles marrying Camilla to begin with, and a completely different string of US presidents following Nixon. Now, some of these changes do get incorporated into the show and plot lines, while others come in the form of bonus videos that you can watch on Apple TV+. And early in season one, we were introduced to the idea that certain green technologies, like electric vehicles, were catching on in a modern way earlier than they have in our real timeline, helped in part by the extra funding going into space technologies. This has continued throughout the seasons, and now in season three, the transition to electric vehicles is not only nearing completion, but huge strides were made in the field of nuclear fusion, which actually led to global warming levels decreasing in the late 80s. And there's a whole plot brewing now about the need for helium-3 in this particular nuclear fusion reaction, and how the moon holds huge deposits of that isotope, so we'll need to mine the moon. All things based in actual theories in our world. But I bring all of this up to say that alternate realities like those in which clean energy sources have been achieved en masse can make me pretty choked up when thinking about how we are probably too late for any kind of one solution silver bullet in our world. Even if we achieve some form of nuclear fusion in the coming decade or so, that alone will not reverse all the effects of human-caused climate change. And that reasoning holds true for most huge, ambitious propositions. We need instead a ton of action in a ton of different directions. So bear all of that in mind with this next piece of news. Researchers at Xidian University in China say that they've made a breakthrough in space-based solar power with a 246-foot-tall steel tower power plant. Quoting Interesting Engineering, "In theory, the Xidian University power plant will connect to orbital satellites that will harvest solar power 24/7 due to their geostationary orbits before beaming that energy down to Earth via high-frequency microwave beams. The power plant will feature five different subsystems aimed at developing space-based solar power arrays. Space-based solar power has great potential as it can collect energy continuously while sidestepping common problems such as bad weather and waiting for daybreak. However, hurdles do remain, such as assessing the effects of high-frequency energy beam on communications, air traffic, and the well-being of nearby residents. Xidian University's new ground station is part of a space-based solar power proposal called OMEGA, which stands for Orb-Shape Membrane Energy Gathering Array." End quote. And Gizmodo explains it a little deeper, quote, "In theory, satellites could continuously collect photons from the sun, convert them to electricity using photovoltaic cells, and wirelessly beam that electricity as microwaves back to the receivers on the surface, like the one at Xidian University. And while the idea sounds like a far-fetched engineering problem for our descendants, it was actually proposed as far back as the 1960s by scientist Peter Glaser. Space-based solar power could sidestep some of the fundamental issues with solar power collection here on Earth. There's no need to wait for daylight or clear weather to harvest the incoming energy, but like most space-based solutions to real-world problems, the main issues would be the cost of launching these satellites and building the space-based solar collectors, in addition to some dicey technological and safety hurdles," end quote. But on June 5th, the university ran a successful test of the solar plant, which was first proposed back in 2014 by Duan Baoyan from the university's School of Electromechanical Engineering, 2 years after NASA introduced their own similar solar power satellite via arbitrarily large phased array, or SPS Alpha. And quoting again from Interesting Engineering, "NASA says that if successful, SPS Alpha will make possible the construction of huge platforms from tens of thousands of small elements that can deliver remotely and affordably 10s to 1000s of megawatts using wireless power transmission to markets on Earth and missions in space. China's Omega project, meanwhile, has successfully transmitted energy wirelessly as microwaves over a distance of approximately 180 feet. This capability puts the project 3 years ahead of its original schedule," the university says in its press release. Still, Baoyan concedes that a lot of work is still required and fully operational space-based solar power could still be years away. End quote. And as for widespread transmission of space-based solar power, Baoyan says that would be more like generations away from implementation, which again is probably too late to make the kind of miraculous impact that these types of solutions are kind of touted as promising. So the question becomes, if we need to execute as many solutions in as many directions as possible, how do we fund them all? Especially when ones like space-based solar power and nuclear fusion require such massive amounts of money. You know, we can't put all of our eggs into one basket, but some of these projects require just about all the eggs in order to succeed. It's enough to make my head spin and go crawling back to my alternate reality drama show where some screenwriters conveniently figured all this out for us. Well, two more quick things before I go. Not to be outdone by Beyonce, he wishes, Drake just dropped a surprise new album called Honestly, Nevermind. It's got reviewers divided thus far, but having literally only been public for a few hours as of recording, you know, give it some time. I gotta agree with my friend, author Preeti Chibber, though, that the Drake drop I am most stoked about today is the announcement of a solo Tim Drake series coming from DC Comics this September. Tim Drake Robin will have Batman's number one side piece going solo as he battles a new villain in Gotham City. But that's all I've got for you this week. This show was produced by Ride Home Media. I'm Jackson Bird, and I will talk to you again on Monday.